I am just so honored to be here and so excited to get to talk to some real kindred spirits, which I don't always get the chance to do these days. So today I wanted to talk about what does and does not count as healthcare in this country. And for me, the story begins in 1995, which was a year that changed my life. So thinking I wanted to be a lawyer, I sign up for a freshman year internship in the housing unit at Greater Boston Legal Services, where I'm assigned to this righteous, deeply inspired lawyer named Jeff Purcell, who proceeds to thrust me onto the front lines from the very first day. And over the course of 9 months, I have dozens of conversations with low-income families in Boston who present with housing issues because we're a housing unit. But whenever you scratch the surface, there's always an underlying health issue. My very first client is about to be evicted because he hasn't paid his rent. But he hasn't paid his rent because he's been paying for his HIV medication and can't afford both of those. A mother comes in, her daughter has asthma, but wakes up every morning in an apartment filled with cockroaches. And one of our litigation strategies is sending me into the homes of our clients with these large glass bottles to collect the cockroaches and hot glue gun them to poster board, which we then bring to the courthouse, and we win all of our cases because the judge is so grossed out that she doesn't want us in the courtroom anymore, which is, for the record, way more effective than anything I later learned in law school. But during the course of these 9 months, I grow frustrated feeling that we're intervening so far downstream in the lives of these patients. And in June 1995, I read an article about the work that Dr. Barry Zuckerman was doing as then chair of pediatrics at what was Boston City Hospital. And Barry's first hire as chair was a legal services attorney. So from the very beginning, he was thinking about things differently. And with Barry's blessing, I spent about 6 months talking to doctors and nurses in the clinic, and over again, they shared the same story. They said every day we have patients that come into the clinic and the child has an asthma exacerbation and we prescribe controller medication, but we know that the real issue is that this child is living with 12 other people in a dilapidated brownstone with asbestos and mildew. And we don't ask about those issues because there's nothing we can do. I have 13 minutes with each patient. Patients are piling up in the clinic waiting room. I wasn't trained to deal with this stuff in med school, and I have nowhere to turn for help. Now, it seems that it shouldn't be very complicated to design a doctor's visit around what patients actually need to be healthy. But I've had hundreds of conversations with physicians across the country who have said that when it comes to patients' basic resource needs, they practice a don't ask, don't tell policy. So HealthLeads was born of these conversations and born of the conviction that there had to be a better way to harness the assets of our healthcare system to do right by our communities, our patients, and their providers who care for them. So fast forward 20 years, and what's changed? Well, one thing has actually changed, at least in healthcare, which is that we're no longer debating the connection between unmet social needs and poor health. I like to think about this as healthcare finally catching up to public health. So it's now widely recognized today that just 10% of health outcomes are attributable to medical care, whereas 70% are tied to social and environmental factors and the behaviors that are so influenced by those factors. In other words, everything that happens in all that vast majority of time outside the four walls of the clinic or the hospital. And organizations like HealthLeads have proved that it is actually possible to do something about these needs and to do so with real results. In hospitals, community health centers, and integrated delivery systems, HealthLeads has created over 30 of these proof points. Clinics that have shed don't ask, don't tell, and instead armed physicians and other healthcare providers with prescriptions for food, electricity, heat, housing, and other basic resources that their patients need to be healthy. The idea is that if a patient had an issue with her heart, you'd refer her to the cardiologist. If she doesn't have electricity, you should be able to refer her to the utilities company for shutoff protection. We arm a well...
Electrocutioner or something.
Thankfully, not that. Thankfully, the utilities company. We arm a well-trained workforce. Now, community health workers, care managers, dietitians, promotorists, and yes, college student volunteers with a powerful technology platform. They then fill those social needs prescriptions by working side by side with patients to access the existing landscape of community resources and public benefits. Based on a patient's demographic information, our technology identifies resources in the patient's neighborhoods open right now with maps, transportation, eligibility requirements, and applications for benefits, and enables a lay health workforce to deliver measurable results. In the case of the 14,000 patients that Health Leads directly served this year, 96% either secured at least one critical resource or declined further follow-up from us because they were confident that we had equipped them with the information that they needed to access those resources on their own. And we know that these connections work. So imagine a drug that improved high-risk patients' blood pressure and cholesterol levels, drove multiple other health and lifestyle benefits, and had zero side effects. It would be a blockbuster. Well, one study at MGH indicates that addressing patients' social needs, in this case through Health Leads, is associated with clinically meaningful improvements in patients' LDL-C cholesterol and blood pressure at a level greater than the threshold set by the FDA for a new drug. And further, at a time when, as we all know, healthcare organizations are fighting tooth and nail to hold on to, let alone grow their market share, we found that when you assist patients in accessing basic resources, 69% of them are more likely to recommend their clinic. I'm sure it's not surprising at all to folks in this room that patients are happier when they encounter a healthcare system rather than a sick care system. And to our delight, executive suites at healthcare institutions across the country are starting to get it, recognizing that population health cannot be achieved if we limit our field of vision to the four walls of the clinic, a shift reflected in the nearly 1,400 expansion requests that Health Leads has received from healthcare organizations across the country just in the past 3 years. But the reality is that despite all of this momentum and the sure knowledge that addressing patients' social needs is critical to people's health, not a single healthcare institution in this country has yet made screening for and navigating patients to basic resources a standard of care system-wide. Not a single one. And we really need to look this disconnect in the eye. What's the purpose of this whole complicated, expensive, bureaucratic healthcare system if not to deliver health and well-being to our patients? And how is it that this aspiration, that fundamental purpose, has become so untethered from the day-to-day reality of healthcare delivery in this country? How is it that we have the capacity to know and are held accountable for knowing every detail of our patients' clinical comorbidities? But when it comes to their social comorbidities, we settle on the generic, they're on Medicaid, or they're poor. What does that even mean? How is it that so much energy these days is focused on elaborate risk adjustment methodologies for protecting healthcare institutions from the financial impact of social comorbidities, while so little energy is actually focused on addressing these social needs with our patients? How is it that the SVP of quality at a major integrated delivery system that collects thousands and thousands of data points about its patients still confesses to us that when it comes to our patients' psychosocial needs, they're a black box to us? How and when did the very legitimate challenges of keeping the lights on at our healthcare institutions somehow become more urgent and all-consuming than our patients' own challenges in keeping the lights on, or their heat, or their electricity at home? And I just argue that those questions aren't just about the healthcare sector writ large. They're questions about ourselves and our choices. At Health Leads, our sole purpose is to work with providers to take down these key barriers to health, lack of food, heat, housing. And in 20 years, we've connected tens of thousands of patients with the resources they need to be healthy. But as proud as we are of those results, they are simply not good enough. Still, the huge gulf remains between what is and what could be and should be in the healthcare system. So take these data from one of our academic medical center partners. When we launched, our team and the clinic leadership assumed that the screen positive rate for basic resources would reflect the rate of medication population, about 20% of the patients. And instead, we were all shocked to find that 58% of the screened patients reported an unmet basic resource need, 58%, sharing that they couldn't refrigerate their diabetes medications because the utilities company had shut off their electricity 6 weeks ago, or couldn't afford their heat at home to beat back the cold air that was triggering their asthma. So think about it. There are about 70 million Medicaid patients out there, along with countless other patients, many or most of whom we can reasonably assume need some help with unmet social needs. The bottom line is that the number of patients we at HealthEads reach is not enough and will never be enough. And the worst part is that until there is systematic screening of social needs in the healthcare system, we won't even know exactly just how staggering not enough is. So here's the question. What do we all do with these disconnects? My belief is we tackle them head on, because all of you believe that the purpose of our healthcare system is not just to manage disease, but to improve health, because you chose to dedicate your considerable talents to improving health in our communities rather than anything else. The very word patient, as I'm sure folks know, comes from the Latin phrase, one who suffers. What we're really talking about is holding our healthcare system accountable to its fundamental purpose and key responsibility, which is to reduce the suffering of other human beings, which of course doesn't exist solely within the four walls of the clinic or the hospital. To reconcile the reality of our healthcare system and our aspiration for it, something has to change. What we need, what our patients need, what our community needs, and what our healthcare system desperately needs is a paradigm shift. So in 1962, Thomas Kuhn, the American physicist, historian, and philosopher of science, coined this phrase, paradigm shift. He described it as a revolutionary change in the basic assumptions within the ruling theory. Kuhn explained that eventually, in any paradigm, enough anomalies and contradictions accumulate that people begin to question the paradigm itself. At that point, the discipline enters a crisis period, defined, he says, by a proliferation of compelling articulations, the willingness to try anything, the expression of explicit discontent, and debate over fundamentals, all of which are symptoms of a transition from normal to extraordinary. The result, in Kuhn's words, is a revolution. So I don't know about you, but this starts to sound exactly like nearly every conversation that I'm having with healthcare leaders across the country these days. Nobody is exactly satisfied with the status quo. And yet there isn't real clarity about what should replace it. And I think this is where all of you and all of us come in. What's most compelling, what I love about the nature of a paradigm shift, is that it just takes seeing the world differently and then acting on it. So to illustrate his point, Kuhn used this image. Okay, how many people see a rabbit? There's like three rabbits here? Okay, there's five rabbits. How many people see a duck? Wow, see, because I'm kind of a rabbit gal myself. But I think that's the question, right? Is it a duck or is it a rabbit? And it all depends on how you look at it. As Kuhn put it, a paradigm shift entails handling the same bundle of data as before, but placing them in a new system of relations with one another by giving them a different framework. This notion is probably really familiar to all of you who trained in public health. You've probably always seen your work through a broader lens of true population health, even when others in the sector or your own institutions viewed the same facts much more narrowly. So the question is, what would it take for everybody, not just in this room, but well beyond, to exercise the power and the privilege of rejecting the status quo and drawing us closer to a more just and a more rational healthcare system? I think it would take fulfilling three imperatives. Imperative number one is to change the definitions. Our current definition of what counts as healthcare did not come down from the Mount with Moses. The definition of healthcare is of our own construction, and we can choose to construct it differently by including the full set of drivers of health. So take, for example, Carlos, a patient who presents with multiple sclerosis and uncontrolled diabetes in the adult primary care clinic and Mass General Hospital after multiple trips to the ED, hospitalizations, and missed specialty visits. In our current lexicon, there's a lot of names for patients like Carlos: frequent flyer, high maintenance, or non-compliant, all of which assume his willful disregard for the care offered him by his doctors. But with a health leads advocate by his side, Carlos connects to a new bilingual transportation company, navigates the mysteries of scheduling follow-up appointments, and secures vouchers for his medication, and shows up for his next 7 doctor's visits. Most importantly, as his doctor says, now he trusts us and knows that he has a team looking out for him. This work isn't complicated, but if it's done systematically, it is paradigm shifting. In this new paradigm, which addresses patient social needs as a standard part of quality care, Carlos is no longer an outlier, a problem patient, a special case, or a worst case. He's just a guy with a few more comorbidities. Traditional healthcare defines comorbidity as the simultaneous presence of 2 chronic diseases or conditions in a patient. But why? Why isn't a comorbidity the simultaneous presence of any 2 conditions that compromise health? Why do we take note of diabetes and obesity, but not diabetes, obesity, and the fact that the patient runs out of food at the end of the month or can't refrigerate her medication? Imagine if we were to redefine comorbidity to include all of the conditions that influence health outcomes. Right now, our healthcare providers are practicing medicine with 70% of the deck missing, 70% of the health outcomes that are tied to social and environmental factors. And this isn't, to me, an excursion into semantics. Last fall, I had the chance to sit with Ray Baxter, who's the SVP for Community Benefit Research and Health Policy at Kaiser Permanente, one of HealthLead's partner institutions. So to be clear, Kaiser Permanente commits $2 billion, with a B, $2 billion a year in community benefits alone. So these are hardly amateurs at the work of community health. And Ray framed the dilemma this way. He said, there's a spectrum from at one extreme, simply pretending that these issues don't even exist in our patients' lives. And at the other, just going ahead and building the affordable housing. We know that neither of these are the right answer, but we need to understand the sweet spot that we, the healthcare system, should occupy between the two. What is the role and responsibility of the healthcare system with respect to patients' social needs? So what I love about Ray's question is that it sweeps away this false choice between doing everything and doing nothing. And this is exactly what I'm saying about the paradigm shift. It's not about doing everything differently, and it's certainly not about doing nothing differently, but it's about taking what we have in healthcare, our language, our infrastructure, our resources, and choosing to deploy them differently. The facts don't change, but how we see them and what we do with them does change. So the first imperative is around language. The second is about action. So imperative number 2 is to actually change the work to address social needs as a standard of care. To start, we have to understand what our patients really, really need. We need to break the cycle of don't ask, don't tell by expecting our healthcare providers to understand patients' social needs with the same rigor we expect them to understand patients' clinical needs. We'd never be satisfied if a physician diagnosed a patient with cancer. We'd expect that they specify whether it was breast or colon or pancreatic, they would stage it, they would grade it, and we should expect the same around social needs. The fancy new ICD-10 codes will require more detail than ever. So surely if under these codes we can document that a patient was sucked into a jet engine, I kid you not, code B97.33, or pecked by a turkey, code W5813, then surely we can implement a basic screening tool to assess whether she's running out of food at the end of the month or just had her heat turned off in the winter. And if you knew that, like in the clinic I mentioned before, 58% of the patients in the clinic screened positive for a major unmet resource need, food, housing, employment, utilities, or education, you'd probably expect that the clinic would integrate this data into their performance metrics, their strategic planning process, their executive level dashboards, the same way they would clinical and financial data. Next, we have to act on what we learn from this screening. This means navigating patients to the community resources they need to be healthy, just as we would navigate them to a specialist or a home health agency, and identify the workforce who shows up every day with this as their responsibility. We also need strong referral relationships between providers and community partners. No clinician would want to refer to a cardiologist she didn't know, and it's no different for community resources. I want to be clear, this isn't about medicalizing community services. It's about making sure that we hold ourselves accountable for successfully leveraging what's already there for our patients. And finally, critically, we have to collect data on this work. This is still science, but it's actually more precise science. It's holding ourselves accountable for the outcome of health, not just the input of medicine. So can you imagine if NASA scientists took into account the force required to get into space, but not the force required to bring it back to Earth? If they said, we do space exploration, but air travel is someone else's field, so we're not responsible for that last 50,000 feet between the atmosphere and the Earth's surface, that would be preposterous. We would think it's ridiculous. But this is how healthcare is practiced in the United States these days. We somehow think that last 50,000 feet, the actual difference between health and illness, is someone else's business. So how do we go from healthcare to health? And I think this is where Kuhn and his wildlife become really helpful. If we choose to look at the assets of our healthcare system, our technology, our workforce, our infrastructure, through the lens of health rather than disease, then incredible potential is unlocked. And the rabbit becomes a duck. How complicated would it be to add just a couple of questions about food or utilities to existing patient intakes? To use the prescription pad, not just for what patients need to get healthy, but what they need to be healthy, to not get sick in the first place, like heat or housing. To maintain a registry of patients who are hungry, the same way we maintain a registry of patients with heart failure. To deploy our discharge planners to schedule a visit, not just with the PCP, but also to a job training program. Or our financial counselors to enroll patients, not just in Medicaid, but also in SNAP. Kuhn says that during revolutions, scientists see new and different things when looking with familiar instruments in places they have looked before. As if the professional community had suddenly been transported to another planet where familiar objects are seen in a different light. This is all to say that so many of the tools and resources for health already exist. It's our job, your job, to change the paradigm by seeing them and using them differently and more fully. So lastly, and I think most important of all as we enact this paradigm shift is imperative number 3. For us to be the leaders our patients hope we will be. If we can choose to change the paradigm, we can also choose who we are within it. One of my heroes is Tom Lee, an internist cardiologist at the Brigham in Boston and currently chief medical officer for Press Ganey. He advises pretty much everyone in the entire healthcare system, from Geisinger to the VA to the Congressional Budget Office. And as far as I can tell, Tom has scrutinized every square inch of the healthcare system. He spent 3 decades obsessing over value, experience, quality, efficacy, efficiency. But to me, his most profound insight is the simplest. So about a year ago, he and I are sitting in this coffee shop, hunched over some of these, like, eyes glazed over healthcare strategy slides, when he says to me, Rebecca, you know what all of this healthcare strategy stuff is really about at the end of the day. It's just about recognizing that every patient visit is a high-stakes interaction. It's a big deal for the patient, and it's a big deal for you. And all you have to do is be the kind of physician that your patient is hoping you will be. So what would it mean for us, for each of us, if we were the kind of leader our patients and our communities hoped we would be? What choices would we make if we each committed to view the facts of healthcare through this obligation and then acted accordingly? I believe it would mean seeing the whole picture of health standing right before us, refusing to be willfully blind any longer to the 70% of drivers of patient health. It would mean rejecting don't ask, don't tell, and diagnosing Carlos with MS, diabetes, and insufficient transportation. To get there will require taking some risks and performing a few courageous acts. But I believe you'll be in cahoots with some of the most spectacular inside agitators our sector has, folks who have already rejected the prevailing paradigm and are beginning to architect the future. Folks like Nirav Shah, who's the COO for Kaiser Permanente's Southern California region and the former New York State Health Commissioner, who has set out to make social needs a standard of care. In his words, there is no surer path to achieving the triple aim than helping our patients with basic needs. We are fully committed to this work. It is our work, and it is not only core to our mission, but a strategic business direction whose time has come in the value-based world we are creating. Folks like Peggy Troy, the extraordinary CEO of Children's Hospital Wisconsin, who grew frustrated with her community's immunization rates and committed to deploy every patient visit in every clinical and non-clinical setting to screen for and deliver immunizations with double-digit gains in coverage over the past 5 years, and who has now committed to use that exact same methodology to use every patient visit to screen for and address patient social needs. How do you convince a skeptical CFO of the importance of this work? Peggy's answer is simple. If you need to convince him, you probably need to find another CFO. Leaders like Ross Wilson, who's the CMO at Health and Hospitals Corporation of New York, the nation's largest safety net provider with 1.4 million New Yorkers coming through the door and 5 million visits every year, who's committed to address social needs, he says, for every patient, every visit, every clinic, and is rolling up his sleeves on the evaluation and implementation work required to use DSRIP Medicaid waiver dollars to do so. And finally, leaders like Jack Geiger, who probably started it all. So many of you probably know Dr. Geiger's story. In 1965, Geiger founded one of the first two community health centers in the United States in a desperately poor area of the Mississippi Delta. And so many of his patients came into the clinic presenting with malnutrition that he began writing prescriptions for food. And patients would take these prescriptions for milk and for meat, for fruits and vegetables, to the local supermarket, which would fill them and then charge the pharmacy budget of the clinic. So when the Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington, D.C. got wind of this, they were livid. And they sent down a bureaucrat to set Dr. Geiger straight and inform him that they had intended their dollars to be used for medical care, to which Dr. Geiger, by his own account, replied, "The last time I checked my textbooks, the specific therapy for malnutrition was food." So last summer, I had the huge privilege of traveling to the midst of the Mississippi Delta in like a blistering hot summer to join Dr. Geiger at the rededication of the Delta Health Center in his name. And sitting around these battered card tables in the waiting room of the clinic with Dr. Geiger and his compatriots from this era, I feel like I at last understood why his innovation alone wasn't enough to trigger the paradigm shift. While Geiger wrote prescriptions for food, he spent most of the time, in his words, fending off the wolves, outwitting and outmaneuvering the rabidly racist local physicians, politicians, and state medical societies. Just the basics of the work entailed unimaginable risk. One of the stories was of his securing a fleet of U.S. government cars so that his community health workers were less likely to be car bombed. In 1965, Dr. Geiger didn't have the time to think about the work of his contemporary, Thomas Kuhn. He didn't have the privilege or the responsibility that we enjoy of leading during a moment of unprecedented fluidity, when health reform and the changes and uncertainty it has wrought enabled those of us who are willing to seize it, the opportunity to truly shape what healthcare looks like in this country moving forward. Now is the time for all of us to break free of the existing paradigm, its illogic, its failures, its disconnects, and to embrace three new imperatives. Change the sector's definitions, including what counts as healthcare. Change the work itself by assuming responsibility at last for addressing social needs as part of quality care, and be the healthcare leaders our patients are hoping we will be, refusing to do something as important as health with one hand tied behind our back. The crazy thing is that we won't need a single new invention or innovation or insight to get there. We just need to see things differently and act accordingly. It's not a rabbit, it's a duck, and that makes all the difference. Thank you.
We'll do a few questions now. I always hate it when we put off questions and people don't remember the ideas that were stimulated. So let's see if there's a few hands. I could start with one. I guess John.
I worry.
Maybe stand up at least so people can.
The potential for cherry picking. If I'm a healthcare system and I can avoid the people who need all these additional social services and having to invest in the people and the finances that are necessary to do it, it's always easier to avoid the sick person. It's always easier to avoid the person who is socially deprived than it is to actually improve the social deprivation. So how do we prevent in this world of healthcare where competition rather than cooperation has become? So to me, I think the first thing we have to do is agree as caregivers that we want to cooperate, not compete. If we're going to compete, we want to compete against disease and disability, not against each other as clinicians. So, thoughts on that cherry picking issue.
So here's what's so interesting about this is that we are actually seeing just the opposite. So what's fascinating is if you're a healthcare provider and you want to grow your market share these days, Medicaid and Medicare, I mean, those are really the pathways to do it. So what we are fascinated by is watching healthcare delivery organizations that candidly have never really cared about Medicaid or low-income patients, fighting tooth and nail to now retain those patients and not wanting them to go to the safety net providers, to the FQHCs in their communities. I mean, when we launched at a significant academic medical center, we were basically given 12 months to migrate from the community benefit budget to the operating budget of the institution. And so we, of course, said, well, tell us what metrics you want us to measure. And they said, we want you to measure patient satisfaction among our Medicaid patients as a result of Health Leads work. So there's this fascinating thing in play, and I don't want to overstate this, but what we're starting to see is that the forces of competition are actually causing folks to circle around those patients. I think the question is, will they know what to do with those patients? Will they be able to provide high quality services to those patients? And that, I think, you know, especially compared to safety net institutions that have just such a richer and deeper understanding of how to do that. But I'd rather take on that challenge than the one of they're avoiding the patients altogether.
Question here, yes.
Paul, from
stand up, Paul, maybe for projecting.
I'm curious, would you get resistance if you do from healthcare provider organizations, even if they in concept want to do what you do, do they more often say, well, gee, our primary care folks can't incorporate this into their visit, or if they get it and not be able to report it into our EHRs, and then if we report it, what kind of expectations are there on us to follow up? Where are the greatest barriers? What's your answers when you hear those things back?
Yeah, it's such a good question. Health Leads work, Health Leads' first 20 years was really as a direct service provider, you know, in the clinic, creating these resource connections for patients. And the reason why we began that way, even though the vision was always around social needs being a standard of care, was so that we could systematically dismantle the clinic level reasons, excuses that are given for not addressing these issues, right? So like the doctors won't tolerate it, it'll mess up our workflows, we can't figure out how to integrate into the EMR, the front desk won't tolerate another piece of paper. And all I'll say is I think we've pretty methodically put those to bed. And that was part of this goal of creating this cohort of proof point clinics where literally, you know, they went from essentially actively ignoring these issues to having it be a routinized part of each visit. I think the next set of, so that piece I'm actually sort of functionally less worried about. And we've actually launched now a series of learning collaboratives of healthcare provider organizations so that they can share best practices. I think the next order of challenges are kind of more of these structural challenges at an institutional level, and they go to what you were starting to allude to, which is, great, even if I want to collect this data, there's no field in my electronic medical record to do this, right? I mean, there's a little bit, or, you know, there's also still the, well, we don't quite yet get paid to do this, right? And I think what we're starting to see is even exceeding our own expectations, a rapidly growing set of institutions that can look out to the horizon of new payment models and value-based care in 2018 and, you know, 50% of Medicare contracts being value-based and saying, okay, even if we're not getting paid for it in this exact fee-for-service moment, we know we have to build these competencies, and so let's roll up our sleeves and starting to do it. Part of what HealthEats has been doing more recently or the past year or so is actually starting to bring together provider organizations that are on this front edge to start mapping some of those structural and systemic challenges and really, this is their language, not ours, start to engage in true movement building work. You know, in that group are, you know, probably 10 or 15 of Epic's most important customers. You know, how do provider organizations start providing leadership from a sector perspective around these issues? And then within those institutions, you know, what's the individual, what's the personal leadership that will be required, you know, from the C-suite and elsewhere in order to be able to drive this shift forward?
I guess I would sort of push continuing on that theme. Wonder whether we're being revolutionary enough in what you said. You said we need a revolution. It seems to me one of the next steps is to really begin to organize against these powerful structures that create these inequalities, getting the patients and the providers together on the same side. So they're obviously not, there's not this barrier of don't ask, don't tell, or even don't know and don't help, but really people, you know, fighting together and organizing together and doing advocacy together. So maybe we need to move further along that spectrum where we do actually build housing for people. You know, we don't want to find a sweet spot where we're halfway doing that or referring people to agencies that often they're getting runarounds and you have to be fighting them continuously too. So why don't you comment on that, and then I want to introduce Dr. Francis.
Yeah, I mean, you know, HealthEats work in many ways was always about poverty and using healthcare as a extremely powerful platform and vehicle to get at these issues. You know, I think part of why we are so passionate about an articulation of a role and responsibility on the part of healthcare institutions at a minimum to understand patients' needs and start navigating them to those resources is because we expect that as institutions do that, they will begin to understand in ways that they haven't historically. I mean, this is writ large. Obviously, there's a number of institutions that are exceptions to this, but really understand the relative strength and weaknesses of the resource landscape in those communities. How do we convert provider organizations to be critical constituents around the strength of the resource landscape in the communities in which they operate? And, you know, candidly, you know, right now when we go into clinics, they literally will say, I don't know, like, 20% of our patients are on Medicaid. Like, well, you know, if we can start arming them, you know, with the data to be able to say, well, okay, sure, but, you know, more importantly, you know, 50% of your patients are running out of food at the end of the month, or, you know, 30% of your patients are living doubled up or tripled up or otherwise in insecure housing, all of a sudden, provider organizations start to have a vested quantitative business-aligned interest in the quality of that resource landscape. And I think to your point, we begin to see a window of opportunity to mobilize provider organizations and other key actors in the space around the resource landscape. But, you know, we're still at a place where for most institutions, this stuff is, you know, to the language of one of the folks I quoted, is the black box. And I think the first step is to shed some light on the black box and then be able to move to this broader movement building. Thank you.
So the next speaker, and it actually follows perfectly, in terms of really moving into the community and thinking about how to make change and changes. Lee Francis was, I think I can say, one of our best, my favorite primary care residents in Cook County. He was just magic in terms of his relationship with his patients, in terms of his commitment to what we were trying to do at Cook County. He was actually, were you in the first class? One of the first classes of the primary care residency. And there's probably some other primary care residents here. I'm saying something to not credit them equally, but Lee really really stood out for his passion, and of course that meant the main thing we wanted to, when Lee graduated, was to stay at County forever. And instead, Lee went out into the community. He took a lot of those lessons in terms of the needs of the community and serving people and meeting their needs where they're at seriously, and really took a health system, Erie, which was doing good work, to a whole different place in terms of qualitatively and quantitatively addressing community needs, and really is it's really become a legendary in Chicago in terms of the work of the clinic. I just have to, the health center, in fact, that's, I was going to make a joke. My very first patient as a medical student at Rush was a very seemingly demented old guy who was about 90 years old. And I even remember his name. I don't want to say his name, but it was, they were making jokes about his name, the residents, and you know, that guy is out of it. And so I went to him, and I wanted to see if he was oriented. And I said, "Do you know where you are?" And he says, "I don't know, I'm in the center." And I said, "Well, like the shopping center? What do you mean the center?" And he says, and Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center had just sort of combined these different facilities. He said, "Well, they used to call it a hospital, but now it's a center." So Lee is in the family, Erie Hamley Family Health Center, not clinic. And they used to call it a clinic, but actually this is fundamentally different in terms of what the vision and the relationship that Lee is trying to project. And so my 90-year-old patient sort of got it right. And let's hear from Lee. Thank you for being here.